It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Friday is the first official day of autumn. We'll talk to an expert about fall camping and ask you to share your favorite fall camping spots.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Senate Republicans are renewing the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and they're trying to vote on it as early as next week. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, who's co-sponsoring the bill.
Every Republican out there believes that this is a fundamental reason we're in charge. That Democrats have lost a lot of seats backing a bad idea, and we've been the biggest political beneficiary of Obamacare, and we want to try to make patients the beneficiary of our idea. So at the end of the day, will we try again? I would argue that yes, we should.
Also back in the news, Hillary Clinton's loss in the 2016 election. Clinton released a new memoir that dissects what happened in her failed bid for the presidency.
You can share your thoughts by calling us at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of the renewed healthcare battle and Hillary Clinton's return to public life. Call 800-642-1234.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. Sabrina, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this Obamacare repeal effort kind of came out of nowhere. It's been percolating out there for a while. It suddenly got a lot of momentum. Why is that?
Well, I think that it's been a bill that Senators Lindsey Graham and Cassidy were working on in the background as the other efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare by Republicans over the summer failed to pass muster. But now I think they see this last-ditch effort to make one more go or have one more go at overhauling the health care law. And what they want to do, in essence, is to give a lot more control back to the states. But a lot of people have said that as far as the Republican plans we've seen in recent months, this would go the furthest in terms of really shifting the power structure, but also eliminating many of the coverage requirements that were created under the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is a co-sponsor of this bill, I should add, for the Wisconsin audience here. What are some of the other changes that the Graham-Cassidy bill would make?
Well, I think that one of the biggest issues that has come up is whether or not it covers pre-existing conditions. And in essence, it does allow for waivers that would pave the way for insurers to charge sick patients with higher premiums or to potentially stop covering certain pre-existing conditions entirely. It also does eliminate the Medicaid expansion, which was, of course, responsible for some of the biggest impact on coverage under Obamacare. It tries to create block grants, which is a longstanding Republican proposal for Medicaid. We don't yet have the numbers on how many people might lose access to the program if this bill were to go into effect, because the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has yet to score it. One other thing that has come up as well is this bill would eliminate certain essential health benefits as they were deemed under Obamacare, and so that includes maternity care, prescription drugs, potentially also certain mental health services, and it eliminates the health insurance marketplaces, of course, that were created under Obamacare.
Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley was talking to Iowa reporters. He's been quoted today saying, you know, I can maybe give you 10 reasons why this bill shouldn't be considered, but Republicans campaign on this so often that you have a responsibility to carry out what you said in the campaign. That's pretty much of a reason as the substance of the bill. This is a guy who's going to vote for the bill, as I understand it. This doesn't sound like a lot of enthusiasm there.
You know, that's a very striking comment from a top Republican on Capitol Hill, and I think it reflects some of the thinking within the Republican caucus and the pressure that has mounted on Republicans, given the fact that they control both chambers of Congress as well as the presidency and have been unable to follow through on a seven-year promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. But at the same time, they're now contending with the fact that the health care law, despite its flaws, has expanded coverage to upward of 20 million Americans. And so what would be the consequences of enacting this this new legislation, Graham Cassidy, it could very much come down to, as we saw with the efforts over the summer, one vote in the Senate, whether it's Lisa Murkowski from Alaska or John McCain from Arizona. It looks like Rand Paul and Susan Collins, two of the other Republicans, are very much against this measure, and it would need that 51 simple majority to pass. And then it would still have to go over to the House, where you are hearing some skepticism already from Republicans there, too.
Talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian, about some of the top stories and national news. Before we move on from this health care law, there's a ticking clock here for Republicans to get this passed with just a 50 with just 50 votes, plus maybe a tiebreaker from the vice president. What changes after September 30th?
Well, I think that there are a lot of competing priorities before Congress right now, and one of those is notably spending for the federal government. They did kind of kick the can down the road with this short-term deal that Democrats had negotiated with President Trump to raise the debt limit through mid-December, as well as to pass a government funding bill. But one of the other issues that has come before them is the need to stabilize health insurance markets, and that's something that at the moment is a result of some of the insurers pulling out of Obamacare because of a lot of the uncertainty surrounding the law's future. And so I think there's this added pressure when you take into account, you know, the budgetary deadlines that they face, as well as their own goals to also move on to tax reform and then going into a pretty long recess over the holidays. It really is, in the eyes of many Republicans, a now or never moment. But then again, that's what they said as recently as July, when the Senate failed to pass its plan at that time to overhaul Obamacare. So you never know. It seems to be one of these issues that keeps cropping up every 6 weeks or so.
Speaking of things that keep cropping up, 2017 has been about reliving the 2016 presidential campaign, and Hillary Clinton gave us a new reason to talk about that with this new memoir she has out. You covered part of her tour. You went to an event. How's it being received?
Well, I think that it's interesting because there's been some criticism, of course, that has been levied at Hillary Clinton for reigniting the feud in a way with Bernie Sanders. She's very critical of the way in which he inflicted lasting damage in her eyes on her campaign. And then it kind of reopens the rift within the Democratic Party on whether they really embrace the Sanders style of progressivism versus a more centrist, pragmatic approach, which is what Hillary Clinton advocated. And then there's just her being very candid and reflecting on the role that gender played, misogyny and sexism, and how she was treated, and being very direct and frank in how she talks about race and immigrants and some of the anxieties and anti-immigrant attitudes that led to Trump's success. So I think that, you know, there are some people who would rather not have these conversations, but there are also many people across the country, especially when you leave Washington, who I think are very interested in what Hillary Clinton has to say, having been on the losing end of an election that everyone had thought that she was certain to win. And, you know, we'll talk about it, I think, a lot here in Washington, the politics of it, is it the right moment? But other candidates have not been precluded from speaking out. There just seems to be this opposition directed at Hillary Clinton in particular, and I think that speaks more to some of the perception of her that she seeks to address in the book.
On this book tour, an interview asked Hillary Clinton who she preferred, her former opponent Donald Trump or Russian President Vladimir Putin. Here's a clip of that.
Putin or Trump? Yeah, well, I have to take that under advisement for the following reasons. I ran against both of them.
And this has been a lot of the talk in Hillary Clinton's media interviews, and I guess in the book too, which I haven't read myself yet, but she's talking about the Russian interference in the election on her book tour.
Yes, and that's actually a very dominant theme I neglected to mention, that part of the book is Hillary Clinton not only gives a behind-the-scenes perspective in a way that I think is very cathartic for her, having read the book. It's very emotionally raw. It's very candid in a way that a lot of people wish she had been on the campaign trail, but part of her motivation, she said, is also to provide some lessons that she felt should be learned from the way that this particular election played out. And she thinks that there was not enough seriousness that was dedicated toward what Russia was doing when the intelligence community had already said, as early as the summer before the 2016 election in November, that there were clear attempts by Russia to meddle in the outcome, as well as potentially to help prop up Donald Trump's campaign. So I think that this is one of those issues where, you know, this has actually been, of course, a big part of how the media has covered the Trump presidency thus far, with the cloud of the Russian investigation looming over the White House, and Hillary Clinton, especially given her own background as Secretary of State, she dedicates a pretty lengthy portion to discussing and dissecting what Russia is capable of in a way to try and warn the media, I think, in particular, as well as lawmakers, to take it more seriously and to have a better understanding and framing of what Russia's motivations are.
We're recapping some of the big political stories of the week with Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you support Republicans' renewed effort to replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? Do you think that they'll be able to pass it? And what do you think of the Secret Service no longer protecting Kellyanne Conway and Donald Trump Jr.? You can call in at 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the week in Washington. Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian, is with us recapping some of the top political stories.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of Hillary Clinton's return to the public eye with her new memoir. Also, lawmakers in Silicon Valley are at odds over a sex trafficking bill. You can tell us whether or not you think that bill should pass. Call 800-642-1234.
And Sabrina, let's look at that sex trafficking bill. You wrote about this. You've been covering it. It's gotten some angry response from Silicon Valley companies. Can you spell out what's at stake here?
Yes, this is actually an interesting issue that has really pitted lawmakers in Washington against big tech. And Silicon Valley has emerged really as one of the most influential, if not the most influential, industries on Capitol Hill. They now outspend Wall Street 2-1 on lobbying in Washington. And what this is doing, this bill, is amending what's known as the Communications Decency Act, amending a section of that law to open up internet companies to criminal liability depending on certain user conduct. What happened is that there was this one particular site, Backpage.com, that, according to a two-year investigation, knowingly facilitated online sex trafficking. And so the idea here is to tweak existing law that has shielded internet companies in the past from being held accountable for what third-party users post to their websites, to try and bring more accountability and enable victims, especially, to pursue litigation against internet companies if they aren't doing a good enough job to crack down on online sex trafficking in this case. But of course, you know, internet companies are saying that this opens up a wave of privacy concerns, that it could amount to frivolous lawsuits. They say it's not as narrow as it's described to be. And some of the tech giants who are kind of leading the charge against this are the big names, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon. Where it's going to go remains unclear. Yesterday they had the first hearing in the Senate, but it has broad bipartisan support, 30 co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle in the Senate. And as I'm sure you're well aware, that's very rare nowadays in Washington.
Yeah, it seems like the concern is that, okay, if you've got a company that's in effect an online personals ad like this Backpage was, it looks like they specifically covered up what was sex trafficking of minors in some cases. That's one thing. The concern from Silicon Valley is, well, does that mean Facebook has to police all messages to make sure somebody isn't doing something like this? Does that mean Google could be liable if someone does an internet search that ultimately connects them with illegal sex trafficking? Is that kind of the line of concern that they're raising?
Yes, absolutely. And I think especially with social media websites like Facebook and Twitter, you know, just if you, for example, have a line of communications between users, does that mean that Twitter or Facebook are now liable for facilitating illegal activity just by having the existence of that platform through which these individuals can communicate? What the bill's authors say is that, no, this is very narrow, and you have to prove criminal intent on the part of the website itself. You have to say, like in the case of Backpage.com, that the executives or the moderators of a particular website were aware that this was happening and that they knowingly, that's where the knowingly comes in, facilitated it and did not take any efforts to eliminate and report to law enforcement that kind of activity. So I think that that's what really the heart of the issue is. There are certainly some, there's a pressure campaign that's been mounting. Some public figures, such as former UN Ambassador Samantha Power, comedian Amy Schumer, they came out recently in favor of this sex trafficking bill. 21st Century Fox, which is, of course, the parent company of Fox News, they endorsed the bill. So there is some, I think, momentum for it, and the question now becomes, are lawmakers going to stick it to Silicon Valley, where they certainly also raise a substantial amount of money?
Talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics over the last week or so. So some news about Secret Service protection for President Trump's family and a staff member. Donald Trump Jr., Kellyanne Conway, apparently no longer getting Secret Service protection, each for a different reason. Can you talk about that story?
Yes, well, Donald Trump Jr. actually requested to be removed from Secret Service protection. According to reports, he has sought more privacy and said that he, you know, was uncomfortable with some of the encounters that he and his children have had with Secret Service officials. I think that, you know, he suggested, for example, that, you know, one of his sons was sleeping, there were Secret Service agents or chauffeurs who were taking photos of him while he was sleeping. That was something that I think was really angered Donald Trump Jr. And, you know, he at the end of the day is not actually working in the White House in the way that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, for example, are. So it seems like he wants to keep a distance. Whereas for Kellyanne Conway, you've had a slightly different case where the question, I think, is the need for Kellyanne Conway to retain that protection. I do know that it's not immediately clear whether she did it by choice, Kellyanne Conway, but initially she was subject to quite a number of threats, especially given her exposure in the early days of the administration as one of the most prominent faces of the administration. And I think the question has been whether the threat level has changed.
And we've seen stories about the Secret Service being strained, their resources during the Trump presidency. Why is that? Have they had to do a lot of additional security, or are there higher costs because of proximity to Trump Tower and resorts?
Well, there has certainly been a higher cost, and some of it has to do with the president's own travel schedule. As you'll recall, in the earlier days of the administration, he was traveling to his West Palm Beach resort, Mar-a-Lago, almost every weekend. And since he's been going to Bedminster in New Jersey almost every weekend, with very few weekends actually spent in Washington. He obviously has an extended family that, as we were just talking about, has been under Secret Service protection. And these are not children, as was the case with some of the previous administrations living in the White House, but adult children and their families who live in New York and other cities. And then there's also been this other issue where you've had some of the cabinet officials who, of course, are granted Secret Service protection, but who have been using certain government resources in terms of charter jets and added Secret Service agents that is more unusual and is costing the government and, in turn, U.S. taxpayers a lot of money and raising eyebrows. And so I think there are a number of competing factors that have led to the status quo.
Is that something that Democrats are calling for inquiries into at all?
You know, Nancy Pelosi was, interestingly enough, asked about one case in particular where it appears that both Tom Price and Kellyanne Conway had used a $25,000 private 30-seat charter for a round trip from D.C. to Philly. And she, you know, Nancy Pelosi said that, you know, so they should be held accountable, but it doesn't look, and there have been some Democrats who are saying that they would like this to be probed. And this is not the first incident. You also had a scrutiny over Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, reportedly having requested a government charter for his honeymoon with his wife. So, I think that you might see in the Federal Spending Oversight Subcommittee some action, but at the end of the day, Republicans also control Congress, and you haven't heard as much criticism from them. I think there's just so much volume of news that this has sort of been one of the untold stories of the administration, or one of the ones that hasn't really received as much attention, is a lot of these questions around conflicts of interest, in part because we're living in a very unpredictable, high-volume news cycle, and there's only so many issues, I think, that even members of Congress are able to grapple with at once.
And before we wrap up, three Democratic members of Congress were arrested outside of Trump Tower for protests. What were they protesting?
Well, one of the prevailing questions is what the president plans to do about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program under Obama that, of course, provided nearly 800,000 young undocumented children, known as Dreamers, with at least temporary protection from deportation. Obviously, the president decided that he would like to phase out that program and gave Congress a narrow six-month window to enshrine protections for Dreamers into law. So that the protests were very much pertaining to what the Trump administration is willing to do for these kids. We do know that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have increasingly been working with the White House. They met with Trump twice over the last 2 weeks, including a private dinner that didn't include Republican leaders, to try and lay out a path forward. They said that they did agree to come up with some sort of DREAM Act-style legislation that would give these kids a path to permanent residency. But the president wants it to be paired with border security, and that's the operating question, I think, is what does border security mean to Trump? Does it mean the wall? He's been wavering on whether or not he will insist on a wall. And what does border security mean to Democrats? Are they willing to give some concessions in order to find a way to remove the threat of deportation for, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids who came here, who were brought here illegally when they were simply children? They've spent, you know, the vast majority of their lives living here in the United States.
We'll leave it there for now. Sabrina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. She joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Now, Friday is the first official day of autumn, which is a great season for Wisconsin's natural beauty. And one way to explore fall colors and other sights around the state is camping.
What about you? Are you a fall camper? What do you like about camping this time of year? And what are some of your favorite fall camping spots in the state? What advice do you have for people who have never camped in the cooler weather? You can call in now with your ideas and your stories at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Kevin Revolinsky is a travel expert and author of a number of books, including Best Tent Camping in Wisconsin. You can find out more at themadtraveler.com. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Kevin, what makes fall camping in Wisconsin so great?
Fewer mosquitoes. I think that's the first thing that comes to mind. Better temperatures, usually, although today I question that. And then the fall colors and bird migration, a handful of things that make it a little bit different from summer, but at the same time also a bit more comfortable.
It can be tough during the summer to get a campsite reserved if you haven't done it weeks or months ahead of time. Does that ease up a little bit in the fall?
It does, especially during the week. Of course, people are back in school, so those sites are open. And even on the weekends, it slows down a bit. And with the reservation system, you can get an idea ahead of time so you can plan if there are campsites available. And most state parks have first come, first served, so you can't reserve all of them. So if you race to the spot, you'll get one.
And I think a lot of people think Memorial Day weekend to Labor Day weekend, that's the camping zone. And of course, you know, with school being out of session for most of that, that's part of the story. Do you see more people putting it on their radar to camp later into the fall?
I'd say a little bit. The weather's been so nice, and that encourages people to get out before winter comes. You know, so you want to get as much time outside as possible. And just having more availability of campsites, I think, also encourages people.
So it can be in the fall. We did have a really wet summer, but sometimes in the fall, the weather can take a turn. Falls can be a little bit rainier. What do we need to know to stay dry when we're camping in the fall?
Well, obviously, you should have a look at the weather forecast before you go and keep abreast of that situation. But having rain gear, a good tent that's waterproof, the placement of the tarp that you put underneath a tent is important, too. You can't let that come out from under the tent, or it will collect water as opposed to keep the water away. And you have to have warm clothes as well. You really don't know what to expect sometimes. Overnight lows can get into the 40s if you're up north, even in the next couple weeks here. So you're dealing with a nice, pleasant day and then kind of a chilly evening.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to camp, car camping, a camper's tent, of course. Talk about a few of the different ways people can get out there.
Obviously, the easy one, I think, is car camping. You drive to the park, you have a tent, you pitch it there at the spot. You don't have a lot of, you can throw everything into the car. You don't have to plan so carefully. Other people have those, the long pull-in, campers. And that's a whole different sort of camping. You have to have spots that are big enough for that and the hookups for them. You could camp near the car, which is, I think, standard, but some of the state parks have sites that you can hike into, so you're maybe only 100 feet from the park road or a mile from the park road, like, for example, Newport Beach, Newport State Park up in Door County. They have a lot of hiking campsites, so you have to lug your gear about a mile or a quarter mile into the woods along the lakeshore. So that's, getting away from even your car there in that case.
So you got to check ahead of time. Am I near a shower? Am I near a bathroom? And do I care?
That's right. Most of the state parks have modern facilities and also more rustic sites. So you can look on their websites to see the maps of where, the ones that have showers, flush toilets, or they have the hand pump and the pit toilet.
Talking about fall camping with Kevin Revelinsky, author of Best Tent Camping in Wisconsin. Join in with your favorite spots, your favorite things to do in the autumn when you're out camping at 800-642-1234. Kevin, let's name some names. What are some of your favorite places to camp around Wisconsin this time of year?
I always throw this one out there because I had such an excellent experience there a few years ago, Rock Island State Park. It's two ferry rides away from Door County at the end there. And if you go during the week in September, there's nobody on that island. Even the park ranger goes back to Washington Island. There might be the docents in the lighthouse there. But for me, it's a great place to, you can stargaze there at night. You're away from all the ambient light. There's over 10 miles of hiking trails. You've got this amazing boathouse that you can go and hang out in the middle of the night.
It is amazing.
The water lapping underneath. The lighthouse, of course, the campgrounds are rustic, but there is a modern shower and toilet near the boathouse, so you can hike out of the campground there. But surrounded by water, I mean, that's really getting away from it all. And lots of fall colors there. And the birds pass through there. It's a migration route, so.
Yeah, I love Rock Island. I've seen the campsites on the water there, and I've had incredible summer halcyon days there, and other times in the fall, it was covered. I was like covered, but there were many black snakes all over the island. So it was interesting to see the different seasons on Rock Island. So that one's pretty remote. So that's for someone who might be a little more experienced. What if you want to go somewhere that has it's a little closer to civilization?
Okay. Well, depending on what part of the state you're going for. I mean, for example, people in Milwaukee can in a half an hour be at Harrington Beach State Park. And it's got a nice, modern campsites. It's right on Lake Michigan. In Madison, you could get up north in about 3.5 hours. You'd be in the Minocqua area, and you can go to, for example, Northern Highland American Legion State Forest. And there are several campgrounds around there. One of my favorites is also up north, Copper Falls State Park. Beautiful waterfalls, great hiking. The North Country Trail, National Trail, passes through that park, and the campsites are They feel very secluded, even though you're not that far from the next camper. You're really tucked in amongst the trees, but then you've got the modern facilities as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lynette is with us in Madison. Lynette, hi.
Hi there. I have a couple, but my favorite is Wild Loosing State Park over in the southwest corner of Wisconsin.
That's where the Wisconsin and the Mississippi meet.
Just gorgeous.
It is.
A ridge up there that you can, we always try to get our campsite up on the ridge so we can overlook the water. And a second favorite is Point Beach, which is by the water again.
And are you a tent camper, Lynette?
I am. I'm shooting for a trailer one of these days.
Okay. Well, Lynette, thanks a lot for sharing both of those. Point Beach, you were going to say something, Kevin.
That also has a nice hiking trail, and the Ice Age Trail passes through there as well. And they have an historical lighthouse. So.
Oh, lovely. That's
yeah,
one
great
that's
views.
I've heard a lot about, and I haven't made it there yet. Well, I want to ask you, Kevin, about one of the pleasures of camping, one of many, but, you know, campfire food. And you brought in a couple ideas about what you can cook when you're out there. Sometimes I feel like food tastes better when you're outside. Do you think?
Yeah, I think that's part of the joy of camping is getting to eat food that sometimes isn't the best for you either, like the hot dogs, the s'mores, the flaming marshmallows, depending on your tastes. There's a variety of things you can do out there, depending on the equipment you bring along. I think people start with the basics, you know, hot dogs or brats. All of the campsites generally have a fire pit because they don't want you putting your fire in the wrong place. So you can count on there being a fire circle there that likely also has a grill top to it. So even if you didn't bring your own grill and if you didn't bring coals, you can use, firewood either from the wild and bring a hatchet to gather the dry deadwood. But most of the parks sell it right there. And you're not supposed to bring in firewood from more than, I think it's 25 miles from the park to prevent the emerald ash borer from spreading. But you get your fire going, and then once the coals are hot, you can cook on the grill or pull a switch from the forest and skewer your hot dogs and put them into the fire as well. Not into the fire directly, but over the coals, rather. One of my favorite recipes came from Todd Booker at Delta Diner up north. He helped me out with an article I wrote a while back. And he takes Lake Superior whitefish fillets and wraps them in tin foil carefully to make like a pocket so they're sealed in there. And inside, you've got the fish fillet, fresh leeks. He has sliced almonds, lemon juice, capers, and maybe a bit of butter or olive oil. And once you get your coals nice and hot, you put that on the grill for about 10 minutes and it steams the fish in there. So you have kind of a fancy meal for a campsite, I think, but delicious.
Very nice Lake Superior type meal, Great Lakes meal. Well, we're talking right now with travel expert Kevin Revelinsky talking about fall camping.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you camp in the fall? Why or why not? What is your favorite spot in the state to experience Wisconsin in the fall? What do you eat when you're camping? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit. Stay with us on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our discussion about fall camping with travel expert Kevin Revelinsky.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you enjoy camping in autumn? What are some of your favorite places to go to set up the tent, park your camper this type of year? And what advice do you have maybe for someone who's never camped in cooler weather before? What do you like to do? What do you like to eat? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's go to our callers. We've got Mike joining us right now in Rice Lake. Mike, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I'd love to go camping in the fall for all the reasons you guys already said. But also, one of the bigger reasons, the crowds are way diminished and the bugs are less. And it's just a lot easier to get around without all that tourist and summer traffic.
That's true as well.
Lose the crowds in the fall. Another agreeing with you there.
And Mike, do you have a favorite spot?
Actually, it's in Russ County. It's not a state park. It's a county forest. It's the Russ County Forest. In the northwest part of the county, which is about 20 miles west of Rice Lake, where I live. And in about 30 minutes, I can go from the hustle and bustle of, well, the city of Rice Lake to a pretty remote spot. It's, you have to drive 5 miles on a gravel road to get to the campgrounds. There's Perch Lake Campground, which is a rustic campground with the pit toilets, and then Audie Lake Campground, which is way more developed. It's got the pull-in sites for campers and running water and a playground for kids, and a little busier on the weekends. I prefer the Perch Lake when I have a tent. I go with myself or a few friends, and it's never full. And once fall hits, you might be the only person in the campground. It's really great.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Kevin, do you have an ever-growing list of places you need to go camping? Because I imagine you haven't been to every possible campground.
I haven't been to all of them, no. But sometimes I just keep going back to those ones that I like so much.
Okay.
So it's hard to force myself out of my box, I think. But there are so many options, even in the summer when it's very busy. There are still places in the national forest that you can go to, and there won't be a soul there. A couple of years ago on a 4th of July weekend, when everything's pretty much reserved almost a year ahead of time, I went to a place called Chipmunk Rapids, which is in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest, just south of Highway 70 and a bit west of Florence. And there was nobody there. Six sites, rustic, right off the Pine River, a lovely place, and down a gravel road, like the previously mentioned site, and those are almost always open.
I like the name Chipmunk Rapids. Did you see chipmunks near the rapids?
I did not.
Oh.
I was a little disappointed. No truth in advertising.
False there. Advertising.
False advertising. All right, let's go to another caller now. We've got Doug with us in Trevor. Doug, hello.
Hey, I agree with your caller. Fall's the best time when there's not many people. I think spring is even. I like it even more because of the spring ephemerals. But you don't have a lot of people. But my point was, when you're in the fall or the spring, you're kind of bumping in with the hunting seasons. So it's good. I've had a couple experiences that were a bit uncomfortable. You know, no big deal. But to be aware where you're going, if there's going to be hunting, like now bear is open. In the spring, you got the early turkey. And if you can just look on the internet, if there's hunting in those state parks, or I've been up in the Nicolet, you can bump up into, you know, some kind of a little uncomfortable situations. But, you know, respect that it's hunting season, know what's going on. But, yeah, fall, spring, definitely. No people, bugs are low, traffic getting there, good time, yes.
All right, Doug, good points there. What about hunting season?
That's an excellent point about hunting season.
What do you need to do to prepare for that?
Know the dates. most people think, well, deer hunting season. Well, there's other hunting seasons, and I've walked up on some duck hunters that were, you know, shooting off the shotguns, and I didn't know they were there, and it kind of made me leap out of my hiking boots. But, yeah, just being aware of your surroundings, who's in the park, and whether it's allowed there or not, and you should be good to go.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. My favorite place is Wildcat Mountain State Park.
Oh, that's a great one.
What do you like about it, Gail?
Oh, just to get to the Kickapoo and just the canoe. I would get a group together, and I would organize it and take like 2,000 people with
wow.
me, and we would go up and to the group camp. We would rent a group camp.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like we had our own little village there for, you know, the time we were there. But the colors, and you're out a little bit in the wilderness almost, but you're still close enough that you don't feel completely out of it. But there's different things that you can do. That was just fantastic. Mm. Just
do you,
for everybody in the group.
Do you paddle while you're there?
Yeah, we had our whole, we had it really organized where, the guys would go and get the canoes, and then we would jog which way we were going and transport everybody, and every season would be different. We did it year after year, and we'd always try to get the prime color weekend for fall colors.
Sounds great, Gail. We'll have to sneak along next time. 2 dozen people, we can blend in. They won't notice we're there.
We'll give it a whirl. Well, Gail, thank you for that. And Miles in Rhinelander says Willow Flowage. It's 30,000 acres of state-owned land. They have 37 campsites, all free, first come, first serve. You heard of that one, Kevin?
Actually, I have not heard of that one, but there are a number of places you can camp for free. Along some of the rivers, the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway has campsites, the Wisconsin River on the sandbars. Turtle Flambeau Flowage up north is another great place. They've got about 66, I think, campsites, and you just paddle out to, well, that's a paddling situation, of course, but yeah, you can go camp out on those islands, and that's a great way to do it.
Kevin, leave us with a 15-second pep talk to get people out there camping in the fall.
Well, the colors are going to be good this year. You got to get out there and find a place, a park that's got a good observation tower, and enjoy, you know, the beauty of Wisconsin.
And it's coming a little early this year. Peak color, it looks like, seeing it down here already. So maybe up the schedule just a little bit.
Yeah, keep your eye on that, the color watch on Travel Wisconsin, the color report.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Kevin Revelinsky, travel expert and the author of many books, including Best Tent Camping in Wisconsin. Find out more at themadtraveler.com. Kevin joined us to share his advice for fall camping in Wisconsin. You can keep that conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
WPR reporter Bridget Bowden recently spent several months embedded with a class of recruits in the Madison Police Academy. Her documentary titled New in Blue airs tonight at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network and tomorrow evening at 6:30 on WPR's other network, the News and Classical Network. Bridget, good to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first, remind us how long you spent with the Madison Cadets.
I started this project almost a year ago, over a year ago, last September, and I spent about 6 months with the recruits as they went through the training academy.
And we've been talking to you as you did that, and of course, you've been producing news features. What are you doing now in this documentary?
So the documentary is a 30-minute look at the training process. It includes topics like the use of force, implicit bias, all sorts of hot-button issues that surround policing in this day and age. And in addition to hearing from the recruits themselves and the police department training officers, you'll also hear from some people in the community who have been involved in police reform efforts.
And you've been up close in the training process. What is on the minds of the trainers and the police officers when it comes to pressing issues that they're worried about?
Sure. I think definitely the idea that police are under attack like they never have been before. They are facing a level of scrutiny like they never have before is on the minds of the trainers and the recruits. On the first day of the academy, one of the training officers told the recruits that their uniform could, either inspire confidence in the community or it could inspire fear, and they have to be conscious of that.
So, Bridget, I don't want you to give away everything that's in the documentary, but can you introduce us to some of the people that we'll meet?
So we'll meet recruits from the class, including Jessica Gillette, who is a mother. She has a master's degree in peace and conflict studies, and she is very interesting person who's now a police officer in Madison. We'll also meet Ruben Gonzalez, who is also a new officer. And he grew up in Chicago, and actually his brother was a cop there in Chicago.
And why a documentary format for this?
Sure. So policing is one of the most divisive issues that's facing America today. And in Madison, we are not immune to that division. So we really wanted to explore all sides of the issue and be fair to everyone surrounding this issue. So we thought it was really important to give this topic some extended time.
And you mentioned earlier that the police themselves feel like they're under attack or kind of a siege mentality almost. Do you think that, I mean, there's just an implicit benefit in people understanding what the police go through as they're training?
Definitely. I'm not sure I would call it a siege mentality, but at the graduation ceremony, a training officer said that the recruits, when they become officers, were going into the fishbowl, meaning they are going to be under everyone's eye, and everything that they do is going to be scrutinized. So, yeah, I think the more that the public knows about what actually goes into becoming a police officer and what that process is like, then maybe we can have some better conversations.
Well, Bridget, thanks so much for giving us a preview of New in Blue.
Thanks for having me.
WPR reporter Bridget Bowden recently spent several months embedded with a class of recruits in the Madison Police Academy. Her documentary titled New in Blue airs tonight at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. It also airs tomorrow evening at 6:30 on WPR's News and Classical Network. And you can listen anytime on WPR.org. Just search for New in Blue.
receiver out of the game. From the 35, 19 seconds left. Ball pumps, throws, touchdown!
And that was the scene at Lambeau Field 25 years ago today when Brett Favre earned himself a starting spot for the Green Bay Packers that he would keep for a very long time.
Favre came in for the injured Don Majkowski in a game against the Cincinnati Bengals, and Favre didn't start off so great. He fumbled the ball four times.
Packers fans weren't so happy. They were chanting for coach Mike Holmgren to replace him with the third-string quarterback.
But then, as we heard, in a two-minute drill, Favre led the Packers to a tie with a long touchdown pass, and then the extra point gave him the win.
And the rest is football history. Favre started 253 straight regular season games for the Packers, plus playoff games.
And he extended his record streak with other lesser teams after he left the Packers. That, I mean, they say sometimes in football, you don't lose your job, your starter job, because of an injury. Proof to the contrary. Majkowski went out and Favre held on to the job for a whole bunch of years after that.
The only thing longer than his tenure was how long it took him to quit playing for the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, he just kept going. And, you know, Packer fans, you hear this every week, pretty lucky having, you know, Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers covering, what, I don't know, 2.5 decades of their starting quarterback position. Doesn't get much better than that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.